Welcome to the EI podcast. I'm Paul Lay, senior editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm delighted to say that today I'm joined by Helen Thompson, who is professor of political economy at the University of Cambridge and a fellow of Clare College there. Hello, Helen.
Pleasure to be here, Paul.
Yeah, no, it's good. There are certain things we won't talk about today in our review. We won't talk about the Ashes.
No.
And I promise not to talk about West Ham United either, even though I could talk all day about Aston Villa's success. So we'll keep that off.
The only game that I've actually seen in the last 10 weeks, because of my father being ill, is the game we lost to Villa.
Oh, God. Okay, sorry. Well, yeah. Apologies. We'll draw a line there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Well, what I want to talk about today really is this extraordinary, uncertain world, fragmented, perhaps more unpredictable. And just want to look at why. We're often told it's becoming more dangerous, it's more uncertain. But I think it's probably less clear are the reasons why that's the case. And are we seeing a temporary phase, a kind of interruption, or is there a deeper structural shift to geopolitics, to global politics, and what those things about 25 might tell us? So if we had to characterise 2025, mid-2020s in any way, would you see this as a redistribution of power, a shift in the global balance? Or is it a more fundamental breakdown of those systems, that global order?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that there is a fundamental breakdown of an order. The more difficult part of that is what the order was that was breaking down. Because I generally am of the view that there's been very little order for pretty much all of this century. So for like 2.5 decades now, and particularly since around 2005. So that's 2 decades of this. And notably, putting the departure point, if you like, there puts it before the 2008 crash.
Yeah.
I think if you then want to say, well, what is going on? Why is that the case? Multiple things are going on. But I think that the two things that probably tie it together are multipolarity. So the rise of Chinese but also of Russian power, which I still think is underestimated, and the breakdown of an energy era. I'm not even sure I would call it an order, but an energy era that ran from around 1982. So that's when oil prices went into a period of being structurally low. I mean, there were obviously ups and downs within that, and the bigger oil price crash happened in 86, but that ran to the early 2000s. And the change then began with China's spectacular economic growth in that period of that decade. So China's accession to the World Trade Organization. And then it was compounded by what was a stagnation in oil production prior to the US shale oil boom. And so I think that we could then characterize the last 50 years as the 70s crisis running through to the early 80s, which in lots of ways has some things in common with what is happening now, though I would say that what's happening now is ultimately more destabilizing, an interlude that ran through to the early 2000s. And then we've been living in this much more complex and disorderly world since. And I think that the China part of the oil story and the Russia part of the oil story, so Russia was the one oil producer that didn't then stagnate in the middle of that decade, tie together into the multipolarity story. Now, it's complicated then, I think, by the 2010s, because actually, in some ways, but I stress only in some ways, we see a resurgence of US power in the 2010s, both because the US becomes a major oil and gas producer again, or again in the case of oil, and becomes an exporter in the case of gas, but also because the financial crash and the aftermath of the financial crash significantly increases American monetary and financial power. So although the world is in a number of ways becoming multipolar, or became multipolar, it also has been dealing for at least now a decade, perhaps a little bit more, with a more powerful the United States in some areas. And I think that's partly the ways in which understanding what's going on is complicated, because you can too easily get, or we can too easily get into, it's the rise of China and the fall of the US, or the decline of the US. But it's not that simple.
No, I'm interested in that particularly, because if you go to the United States, it doesn't feel a country in decline in the way that Europe does. There's a kind of sense, an almost decadence about much of Western Europe in particular. And I mean, UK is a kind of classic example of this. But what you're suggesting is a kind of tripartite settlement there. There's obviously US and China, and we see this kind of almost Manichaean struggle the way it's portrayed. But Russia, you're saying it's underestimated. I wonder how that all fits together, and also raises the point about how much this is ambitions fulfilled and how much it's contingent, this new world disorder, if you like.
Well, let's just take the US point first. I think that if we think of the relationship between the United States and Europe and sort of bracket at least China out of it, then we can see that from 2008, from the crash, and then in the few years after that, the shale boom in the United States, that a quite significant economic divergence occurred between the US and Europe. And you can see that in a number of ways. And it's not actually that complicated a story in some respects. And the United States was, in that period in the 2010s, both able to push Europe into things that didn't particularly want to do. And I would say, as an example of that, the first sanctions on Iran that the Obama administration put on in 2011, a position that the European states had been resistant to for more than a decade by that point. When I say sanctions, I mean serious oil sanctions, with the attempt of bringing Iran to the negotiating table about the nuclear deal. I think you could also see it in the pressure that the Obama administration put on Merkel during the Eurozone crisis at that time. And then at the same time, or in the few years coming after that, you see the US really pressurizing European gas markets by, well, from the US shale companies wanting to sell into European markets, open them up to liquefied natural gas exports from the United States, particularly in those states that had been dependent on pipelined like Russian gas. So in that sense, Europe became a site of geoeconomic competition between the US and Russia, where energy markets were concerned. And if you like, the prize of that was Germany. And with what happened when Russia invaded Ukraine, indeed, actually, in the few days before that was the case, because that's when Scholz repudiated Nord Stream 2, the US won its victory in that respect. And that's proved like very disruptive to Europe. So I think one of the ways in which the United States seems a very different place to Europe now is because economically, Europe has experienced a profound economic shock. And it's actually been an ongoing economic shock. Mm. And compounded in Germany's case by something that's separate, in a way that's separate anyway, which is from 2018, then really being hit by a succession of China shocks.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Germany's economy was singular within Europe in the way in which it related to China. And China's high-tech manufacturing ascendancy has really hurt the German economy. I then think there's something else going on that's more complicated, which is to do with the importance now of the Western Hemisphere in geopolitics. And in some sense, the relatively less importance of Eurasia, particularly at the European end of it. And I do think that this is structural, in the sense that if we look historically and think about the point in which the United States ascended as a geopolitical power, a serious geopolitical power, at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, that essentially was the point in which it controlled the Western Hemisphere and moved out into Eurasia, getting its first colony in the Philippines. And I think if we think in retrospect, at least, that was only possible really in a context in which China was weak and very weak. Mm-hmm. So that Imperial China was entering its last decade, yeah. like at the time. So if you then have a world that's been transformed by China's economic transformation, and you have a world in which China is a world trading like power at the time in which the United States power has waned, particularly in relation to the exercise of military power, I think you would then expect the Western Hemisphere to be contested. And we can see that. I mean, we can see that in terms of China's commercial presence in Latin America. We can see that in the conflict over the Western Hemisphere parts of the Arctic, like Greenland. And we can now see it admitted explicitly in the national security strategy that the Trump administration put out.
Like, and this threatens the Monroe Doctrine.
Absolutely. And that China threatens the Monroe Doctrine. Mm. And that hasn't been true. Nobody has really threatened the Monroe Doctrine in the time in which the United States has been a serious geopolitical power. I mean, there's anomalies, like Greenland's an anomaly, the Falklands is an anomaly, but they're not significant enough think. So, and this is where I think that actually what can seem like contingent with Trump, particularly when he says things that you can't imagine any other US president saying, like, I'm going to annex Canada and it's going to become the 51st state. Yeah. When you actually put it in this longer historical perspective and see in some ways how odd the United States' rise as a geopolitical power was, particularly given that it's a continental state that became that through conquest, and that I think it is dependent upon China's weakness at that time, then in some sense this is history reverting to something that looks a bit more normal.
Yeah, and we often forget that during the 19th century, you know, the United States was quite insular, didn't it?
Yeah.
It didn't gravitate towards Europe in that sense, apart from the old ancestral links. Yeah. I mean, it was very much obsessed with that continent, and the Monroe Doctrine comes out of that.
Absolutely. And I remember on the week that Trump moved into his mega trade war, what seemed at the time like his mega trade war, in April of this year, I was doing something in the United States and had a quite complicated like flight to get to California. And I was flying over the desert at the time for hours. Mm. And in some sense, when you do that and you realize just like the United States is nothing like Europe.
Just the actual territory of it
and what it would mean for that state to become a continental
state. And also
state.
I think the European focus on the West Coast and the East Coast always forgets the interior, the vastness of that interior, the rise of the Sunshine Belt, the rise of Texas in particular, I think.
Absolutely. And so once you like think about what kind of state the United States actually is, and you put that together with the circumstances of its geopolitical rise and the centrality of China's absence to that and the importance of the Pacific, then this sort of period of time, which we can't argue when it starts, but let's just say for the sake of argument that it really takes off from like the Cold War, early Cold War through to the 90s, in which there's this stress on like the complementarity of Europe and the United States, or at least Western Europe and the United States, this notion of like the West. It just kind of seems quite false. It just seems like it was quite profoundly an illusion.
But it works both ways, I think, that with Vance's comments and this curious American, this new establishment, if you might call them, of whom Vance is perhaps the most articulate of them, this obsession with Catholicism, this obsession with Europe, seems very strange to me and indicative of something that I can't quite grasp.
I think that that, in the way, is another version of the same illusion. And it's interesting that there is somebody in the US administration who's asserting that at a point when actually the underlying thrust, if you like, of the administration is a recognition of the US's territorial singularity, the importance of like the Western Hemisphere. And there's Vance talking this civilizational language.
It's almost defense of Christendom.
It is, absolutely. And that actually, in his mind, then Europe matters because it's the origin story.
It's the font.
But actually, it's not the origin story at the best, it's a partial origin story.
It's essentially medieval.
It doesn't explain anything about the territorial expansion of the United States. I know that it does in the sense that you've still got like Protestant like settlers doing that. But the bit that he's harping on about, which is pretty Catholic, it's not there.
No, absolutely.
And you and it's actually coming the other way. It's coming from, if you're going to do that, you've got to start on the West Coast. You've got to start with Spanish California.
Yeah.
And then, but then you've got to think about Mexico, because that's central to the entire Mexico war
and
in 1840.
And Latin America in general.
Absolutely. It's the reason why the United States has the border it does with Mexico.
But that's the interesting bit there. I mean, if we look at what's going on in Venezuela, if we look at the success of Milei, and it appears to be a success in Argentina, we look at the recent election results in Chile, we can see that that is a contested land of which the United States plays a key role in that. I mean, the support given to Milei, the lack of support, quite the opposite in Venezuela, you know, it is asserting itself on that continent in classic Monroe Doctrine fashion.
It is. And I think the other part of that, as well as the reversion, if you like, to the historical norm, or at least that what might have been a more expected path of world history, if you like, is the fact that the Western Hemisphere is the place at the moment where energy and resources, the extraction of energy and resources, are growing. Mm. So if you could include the shale boom in this, pretty much the entirety of growth in oil production over the last 15 years or so has come out of the Western Hemisphere. Obviously, predominantly US shale, but also Canadian tar sands, and now Guyanan or Argentinian shale. If you say, like, why is the Trump administration focused on Venezuela? I mean, Trump's made that very clear. He describes it as our oil, meaning that the investments of US companies were nationalized under, like, Chavez, and he says, you know, you want it back. But it's also because the crucial energy transition metals, not least lithium, are abundant in Latin American countries, particularly actually Chile. And that is a good part of what's drawn China in.
Yeah.
And so if the United States is going to break China's ascendancy through metals, then it needs in some sense to break China's presence in the Latin American countries.
And on that, it was interesting when you were talking about Merkel, talking about political commentary here, of how catastrophically people got that wrong. I don't want to pick on particular people, but we remember, you know, Germans do things better and all this, that and the other that was going on there, which was a fixed kind of doctrine for quite a while. Completely wrong. And it revealed to me just how difficult, yourself accepted, of course, is how difficult political commentary is and how often people get it catastrophically wrong, using often analogies of the past. And this is coming back to the US-China business here. It's often that rivalry between US and China is often described as a new Cold War. Mm. It can't really escape those past analogies. And I wonder if that analogy is really useful at all.
Yeah, I don't think that it is in a number of respects. I mean, if you look at the origins of the Cold War, you can't detach them from the Second World War. Mm. And that means you can't detach them from what had been the wartime alliance between the United States and the Soviet Union, at least for 4 years of the war. And there's nothing that looks like that in the US-China relationship. You'd have to translate that into the trading relationship. If you then try and think about it in economic terms, you can't really see some prior significant US presence in the Soviet economy. I mean, outside the possibility at one point, which wasn't really run with, that Standard Oil would help Lenin develop the Soviet oil industry, and it didn't like materialize. So again, you try and translate it into trade dependency.
They're separate
spheres. It just doesn't work. But I think the other thing that's really striking is that at no point, I think I'm right in saying this, in the Cold War, given that the United States is willing to accept Soviet control of Eastern Europe effectively, is there a major territorial conflict that involves the Soviet Union's claim to territory of that it would claim as Soviet, or that it wanted directly, like, to control on its borders? I mean, I suppose you could argue about Afghanistan, but it's more complicated, I think. Whereas what's central to the geopolitical aspects, at least, of US-China, at least in its capacity to, at least in its, that it contains the possibility of actual war, is Taiwan. And that is something that China territorially claims as China. That's where you can't, I think, find some Soviet, parallel. Mm. So in that sense, the possibility of a actual war over something that is existential for the US rival is much clearer in this case than it was in the Cold War.
I mean, that economic interdependence that's there between China and the US, not just China and the US, you've talked about the problems that Germany has as well with its relationship with the Chinese economy. Does that make it more dangerous? I mean, one of the other significant differences between the US and the Soviet Union's relationship in that US and China is that China's not going anywhere. It's a civilizational state in that way. It's been through, you know, you talked about its 19th century, that lost century in many ways, but it's re-emerged. It's a major power now. It's one of two or three major global powers now. It's not going to disappear. Does that interdependence make conflict more likely, or is it less likely in the fact that the two of them have to live with one another, you know, in the way that the Soviet Union disappeared and it was a kind of US project to make it disappear, that there was something just wrong about it. It was seen in moral terms. It has to live with China. China's not going to disappear. They're not going to change the politics of China particularly. Does that make conflict more likely or less?
I think that's a complicated question, partly because the United States did still and does still have to live with Russia. Except I think that there are, as we've already suggested, like important differences between US, Soviet, Russia, like US, China. I think that in one sense that they are condemned to competition with each other, even if we leave the Taiwan issue aside, because you could imagine circumstances which, you know, Trump is already in a way hinting at, in which the US cedes over Taiwan, is that it's quite difficult, I think, to see how they escape the resource competition with each other. And I think that that is something that makes it, again, quite different from US, Soviet Union.
And this is the issue of technology as power.
As well, and I was going to say, and then that's now compounded because one part of the overt competition between them is AI, and AI is electricity intensive. And so actually, despite the fact that any number of people over the decades, really centuries even, thought that technology is some kind of substitute for energy, here we're seeing very clearly that that's not the case. And that actually, if you're going to compete over technology, you're going to compete over energy. And China is not in any way energy self-sufficient. And the United States has a higher degree of energy self-sufficiency, but it's not anywhere like energy self-sufficient. And crucially is that the tech industry that is super keen on more electricity specifically wants nuclear power. And the United States imports almost all its uranium, or certainly its enriched uranium. And so the United States can't quite detach from resource competition in a way that it did in the period of the Cold War, but at least until the 70s, when after US oil production peaked. So I think that that alone means that there's going to be a high propensity to competition. And if you are the United States and you have metal dependency on China in certain areas like rare earths, then you are going to want to end that. And I think we've seen that quite clearly this year, because the thing that I think has probably rattled Trump more than anything this year was China's deployment of the rare earth embargo. And that is the reason why he wasn't able to fight that trade war in anything like the way which he imagined when he started it back in April. But if you look at the concentration of supply chains in both mining and in the processing of mining, I think really that for the United States to do better at that, China's probably got to do worse at that. China's not going to just stand there and let that happen. So in that sense, I fear that the, at least some of the interdependency actually intensifies the possibilities of conflict rather than reduces it.
And it's interesting, coming back to the Latin American point here, could it be possible that the issue of Taiwan as a kind of extension of China is linked to the United States' relationship with Latin America as an extension of the Americas?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you can definitely see the way in which the US-Mexico border in particular gets tied up with these questions. including because of the fact that the drug manufacturing, fentanyl manufacturing in Mexico is coming from chemical products exported from China. But I think you can also see another connection that comes out of the importance of the US-Mexico border, which is the Ukraine question. If we think of like Ukraine and Taiwan as kind of like parallels in some ways, because the point in which US funding for Ukraine first became seriously complicated is well before Trump returned to the presidency. It's the autumn of 2023, when all the Senate Republicans, so including people like Mitt Romney, who'd been pretty pro-supporting Ukraine, were willing effectively to tie ongoing funding to Ukraine to the Biden administration moving its position on the US-Mexico like border. And that held up funding for months before there was a resolution to that, because in the minds of any number of the American political class, certainly on the Republican side, that border is like existential. And then you say, well, why is that border existential? In part because of China's presence in Mexico. And one of the few things in a way that Trump has achieved in his trade war this year has been to push Mexico into a significantly more confrontational trade policy with China. And you can see why. Because of the US own trade agreements with Mexico means that Mexico otherwise acts as a backdoor for China into the United States. So in that sense, we can see a lot of ways in which I think people wouldn't have noticed 10 years ago, in which what happens in Latin America actually ties up all the geopolitical questions of the world.
Yeah. Well, you've mentioned Ukraine. We can hardly avoid the issue of Ukraine. I just want to ask you two questions, I suppose. One is about where you think American policy will end up on Ukraine. And I suppose, secondly, to what extent has the war in Ukraine transformed or may transform Europe into a more serious strategic actor?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Trump's second big blow of the year, I think he's actually taken quite a lot of blows given his ambitions. But it probably actually ranks the same as the rare earths embargo, is the fact that he's not been able to force Russia to end the war. And if you go back to the period between Trump's election and the inauguration, he was full of, you know, bravado on this subject about how the war was going to end in 24 hours. And nothing that he's done, either in terms of being more confrontational, so the sanctions on Rosneft, for instance, or being more appeasing in terms of effectively saying that Russia can have territory that it hasn't yet militarily taken, has succeeded in that. So I think that there isn't really any alternative for the Trump administration to keep going with trying to find the way of bringing Russia to the table. And that it's unlikely to go back, I think, to saying, right, we're just going to massively back Ukraine. I just think the domestic political space for this administration to do that just isn't really there.
Because support for Ukraine still remains strong in Europe.
Yeah.
Very. At least in terms of polling.
Yeah. In Europe, it's obviously a more complicated question. I think you can still ask some like quite hard questions about like what the German government actually thinks about this question. Because on the one hand, Merz has allowed himself really in some ways to be humiliated over the last few weeks in terms of not being able to force other EU states to agree to using the frozen Russian assets as the basis for this loan to Ukraine, and having to agree to new common debt for the European Union, or most members of the European Union to do that. And given how averse that Merz has been to, or Germany in general, since the pandemic, and Merz perhaps in particular, to common EU debt, that's a major, major climb down. It's not just that he didn't get his way over the frozen assets, done something that has been effectively a taboo for German politicians since the pandemic. It's just giving Macron, in that sense, like what he wants.
Yeah, well, this is a problem, isn't it, and for Europe in general, is that you have the two countries, UK and France, who've been generally military assertive and will spend power. They're in a kind of fiscal position where they can't do that really anymore. The one country that can is Germany, I suppose, invest. But is it investing in the wrong things? Is its idea of war, of Europe's idea of war, now outdated? in its support for Ukraine, which becomes very explicit if you look at the nature of the way in which war is changing rapidly in Ukraine, that I don't think is fully understood. And it comes back, I suppose, to your point about energy. Drone manufacturing would surely be the best thing that Europe could do. Germany has the capability to do that, but seems unwilling to do so for whatever reason, often I think because it fails to grasp the changing nature of war.
I think that's true. I think it's also an issue that Europe's general deindustrialization has now spread to Germany quite deeply. And so the question of like what Germany's going to do about that, I think, is still being contested within like German politics. And there's clearly a part of certainly the German industry that would like really to double down on the presence in China as a way of responding to that, even if it means doing much more production in China. So then the question about where defence production might fit into that and what kind of defence production, I think, becomes complicated. I think the other question, though, is about the war itself and like whether Europe as a European Union, and perhaps particularly whether the German government has a clear idea of actually what it is trying to do here. I mean, is the plan actually to say we will keep funding Ukraine for as long as it takes? But nobody, I think, thinks for as long as it takes would work without some significant extra military help for Ukraine. There's no evidence that any European government really, even the British and the French,
and Putin knows this as well with his comments last week that, you know, your children are going to have to die. You know, it's quite a horrific thing. And I suppose that comes back to this. You wonder if European societies could sustain, even if they were willing, higher defence spending, you know, and substantially higher defence spending and energy costs, as you said, without some kind of political backlash.
I mean, if you look at the two states that have talked the talk, the largest states, I mean by that, because obviously the Baltics and Poland have really have.
It's more existential.
And Finland, actually. Yeah. Finland's actually hurt its fiscal position quite considerably by doing it. Finland really has put its like money where its mouth.
I mean, no one understands Russia quite like
Finland. Yeah, absolutely. Did you take like Britain and France? The truth of the matter is that all the rhetoric from Macron and Starmer is just pretense.
There's no big stick left anymore.
And that neither of them are in a position to pass a meaningful budget. Now, you might say, well, the British government is. The French clearly are just going to have to roll over this year's budget for 2026 because they reached the end of the road on these negotiations in like the last few days. It's very difficult to see how a French government, without having there being another presidential election and then parliamentary elections to go with that, is getting it out of this fiscal impasse or political fiscal impasse that it's in. But as we know, the British government can't pass a serious budget. It can pass a budget to appease the Labour Party or appease the parliamentary party for
public sector
a little bit, but it can't pass a serious budget. And there was no mention in the budget of increased defence spending. I mean, supposedly there's going to be something still to come, but nobody looking at that, not least Putin, would think that this is a government that has got the slightest idea how it would increase defence spending in a political sense.
So what's the outcome of all this?
So I fear that, well, there's two things, I think. First of all is that Trump could succeed by the stick or the carrot in getting Putin to stop.
And with the gains.
Europe would just be bypassed in that respect. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily bet on it because, as I say, he's been trying all year and not succeeding. Not really succeeding at all. I mean, the second thing would be that he can't, and that what Europe does, the European Union and the European individual states, is provide this piecemeal funding to Ukraine where the Ukrainians keep fighting without really getting anywhere, but that for the European Union, quite cynically in particular, that it sort of freezes things as they are and stops the European Union having to deal with the really hard question of what then for Ukraine if there is peace, and redeeming that commitment that they've made, that there would in the end be accession of Ukraine to the European Union. But even that cynical strategy, I think, runs into the difficulty of, well, how many fixes are there going to be at the European Union level for funding for Ukraine? Because I think that what was revealed in the discussions that led up to the decision of doing it by common debt rather than frozen assets is there's now quite considerable scepticism, not just in the obvious places like Hungary, Slovakia, but in Western European countries, and particularly Belgium. You know, and I think it went, if you look at what was going on, it went beyond the Euroclear issue. And it's there in Italy as well. These are like founder members of the
But what do you think it is that the populations, the electorates of those countries actually want? Is it just more stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the difficulty is that for any European countries or West European countries, politics, I'll rephrase like that, is it's very difficult for any politician, regardless of whether they're from the right or like for the left, to identify a clear economic strategy for raising most people's living standards, or even just the majority of people's living standards. And in that sense, the political problems that they have are a reflection of Europe's structural, or Western Europe's structural economic crisis. So those places, like here, obviously, where early industrialization and relative success at that led to certain material expectations that are now much more difficult
to sustain.
And I think that then it's not really, I think it's just that the politicians don't know economically what to do, and that they then don't know what politically to do in the face of the fact that they don't know what economically.
So what could they do economically?
Well, I think in terms of Europe, it is pretty hard, but I think that they have to get to grips with the energy problem.
Yeah, so this is the decarbonisation project.
Here, yeah, I mean, but that's, I think, problematic in a double sense, because the bet, and you could see this pretty clearly in Britain, because it was bet upon by the Boris Johnson government as much as by the Keir Starmer government, was that decarbonisation and electrification was the means of reindustrialising. And it was a means of higher growth. I mean, if you go back to Boris Johnson's rhetoric, it was also the means of strengthening the union, the Anglo-Scottish union. It was supposed to be a fix-all for everything, ignoring the fact that actually there were any number of fundamental problems with the conception of net zero by 2050. So in that sense, reducing higher energy costs, particularly for industry, needs a substantial rethink, and it probably can't be done within the net zero framework. And I think you can see some movement in some European countries, particularly Germany, away from that. You can't at the moment really see any movement away from that in the British case. Indeed, in a way, you might argue that at the earlier part of this year, there were signs that that was Keir Starmer's direction of travel. And as his leadership's become more and more precarious, that he's actually gone off in the other direction. So the beginning of the year, you might have expected him to remove Ed Miliband from his present job. The end of the year, not only did that not happen, but Ed Miliband seems ascendant in
he's likely to be the next leader
in the Labour cabinet. So I think that Britain is, its politics are not reflecting in this respect what's gone on elsewhere.
Talking of elsewhere, we've barely touched on the Middle East.
Yeah.
Just a small matter of the Middle East. But, I mean, how much is the future of the Middle East dependent upon the United States stepping back from the Middle East, which has been its traditional role? Mm. You know, it's been the arbiter there. I wonder if we're seeing a kind of greater regional kind of autonomy, the role of the Gulf states in the Middle East, of course, the role of Israel. Or are we in for just greater instability?
I think probably there is going to be greater instability as much as anything simply by virtue of the end of the Assad regime at the end of last year in Syria and the blows that Iran took during the course of 2024 that haven't been reversed during 2025, and I'd say the possibility still of like domestic instability in Iran. I think that in terms of the US position in this, I think it's quite complicated because you can argue that the United States has been trying to retreat from the Middle East since at least the early part of the Obama presidency. Yeah, yeah. Not completely to retreat, I don't think, but to reduce its
footprint.
Its footprint in the Middle East, and that actually every American president since, including Obama himself, has got back further in than what their starting position was. Sometimes it's complicated, like what happened, but if you just take the Biden case, it starts off with a fairly strong repudiation of the Saudi relationship, and yet by the, I think it was September of 2022, certainly the late summer, autumn of 2022, he was off with a begging bowl effectively to Saudi Arabia, asking Mohammed bin Salman to increase oil production, and instead he reduced it right in the run-up to the midterm elections. If you take Trump, he's been quite accommodating, I'd say, in some ways in the first part of the year, surprisingly so, about the new regime in Syria. But then actually there's been attacks on, after the attacks on the US soldiers by ISIS, there's been air attacks back. If you look at the Saudi relationship under Trump, there's definitely doubling down on it, now being extended into like nuclear power. So I think that the Gulf states are going to stay very important to the US. And I still find it difficult to believe that any US president is really going to countenance a naval withdrawal from the Persian Gulf. Both because in 5 years' time or so, the amount of oil that the United States itself will need to import as shale declines will increase. Obviously, some hope is being invested in Venezuela, but that oil is some of the toughest oil in the world to refine. It's expensive to extract. The US is still going to have an interest in importing oil from the Middle East, and I just don't see a world in which it really says, okay, we will just cede naval responsibility for the Persian Gulf to China.
And
given that China has got its own interest in importing from the Middle East, that would be what the effect of that would be. So I think that the United States will keep trying to minimize what it does in the Middle East. And I think we may well see growing reluctance to intervene on Israel's behalf in the way which it's done over the last few years. At least that's possible. But I can't see that there's a space for a full-scale structural withdrawal.
Yeah. You've painted this very vivid picture of this multipolar world. I think we're all agreed that we are living now in a multipolar world, which I think instinctively feels inherently unstable, because no one power is willing to lead. I mean, what are the positive scenarios that could come out of that? And I also want to think about how little room there is in terms of debt as well around the world, how that constrains power, because that's a major factor as well.
Yeah, if we were just starting the beginning of the conversation and I said, what do I think the most important things have gone on this year, I would have definitely put the US debt situation there. I think it is a thread that holds quite a number of the threads through the year together, because I think that it motivates part of the determination of the Trump administration to say we're not spending money on Ukraine. And it's pretty clear that there are people in the Trump administration, now he's put one of them in the Fed, like Stephen Miron, who would actually like to tie the debt question to the security guarantees question, to the trade relationship question.
Which is not entirely unfair.
Yeah, ultimately as well to the willingness of the Fed to provide dollar swaps to European states and Japan in particular, and say to the US seeming allies that the terms of the good things that you get from us are that you need to finance our debt at a lower rate of interest than is presently the case. I mean, I don't think in lots of ways that all hangs together, not least because now the amount of debt that's essentially, of US debt that's essentially held by hedge funds and other such financial firms.
And what's the implications of that?
Well, I think the implications of that are interesting, and in that actually that means, which again I think is part of the concern, that the potential for bond market instability is high, and that actually it would be more difficult than it's presently been for the Federal Reserve simply to stabilize markets at those moments of crisis around the US debt, like happened in March 2020 with the beginning of the pandemic.
So how might that scenario play out?
Well, I think that's a very big question. I mean, if you look at what happened in like March 2020, the Fed threw everything at it in terms of like dollar swaps to those who were buying US, who were official holders of US debt, plus an effective backstop for the Chinese at that point that wasn't officially a dollar swap, QE infinity. And we can already see, if we've looked at what's going on in the last 6 weeks or so, that you know the Federal Reserve has moved away from quantitative tightening, formally you know ending the policy, and has what it calls, for technical reasons, returned to what we might call quantitative easing, buying about $40 billion worth of treasuries a month. So I think what we're seeing there is that the Federal Reserve is going to have to be more interventionist in one way or another to sustain the US debt, and that as it does so, the pressure on the Federal Reserve from Washington is going to intensify. And we can see that that's been another thread of the year, of the way that Trump has attacked the Federal Reserve. Jay Powell, you know, pretty emphatically saying that he's been keeping interest rates too high, and that a world in which there is more political control of monetary policy to manage debt, and in the end this will come back to Europe, I think, as well, it's not just the United States matter, is, I think, the direction of travel. And in a way, the fact that Trump is so crude about it and so openly confrontational about it makes it seem it's more to do with him than I think, in fact,
when it's actually an existential question.
In that it's very difficult to see, particularly in circumstances in which the politicians find it so hard to cut public expenditure.
We
can see that in different ways in the British case and in the US case. Because remember, at the beginning of the year, when Trump was appointing Musk to DOGE, you know, Department of Government Efficiency, they're supposedly going to wipe off like a couple of trillion off the US federal budget. Nothing like it. It's another of the failures of the year.
It feels one of the really big questions of our times.
Yeah.
It's welfare spending.
Yeah, and is that, and I think we saw it spectacularly.
In the West, at least.
Yeah, it's spectacularly in the British case. Yeah,
it's transforming the British state. It seems to be, you know, we've talked a lot about existential questions. That seems to be the existential British question.
And as well, I think what's really significant about that moment is that showed that actually the British situation in the fiscal political nexus was actually the same as the French situation, which is bizarre when you think that the French have got a minority government and the British government has got one of the biggest majorities.
Whacking majority, yeah.
Historically, by any historical standards, the British politics, but also, in some sense, the British government should have an easier time governing than anywhere in the world under this.
No.
And actually,
particularly given the parliamentary system.
Actually, quite the contrary. Mm. Actually, I think that showed, that moment, like, showed just, in some sense, the depth of the political problem that we're in. And that exists independently of what one thinks about the rights and the wrongs of the way in which they were going about trying to cut welfare expenditure. For a government with a majority of that size not to be able to get its way and effectively to succumb to backbenchers who are there for no other reason really than because they are a symptom of the British political crisis. Yep. They are there because of how exhausted and pathetic in many ways the Conservative government was and couldn't possibly be re-elected. That's the only reason that they're there. And yet their say prevailed. And that, I think, says something about the depth of the political problem in the UK at the moment.
No, absolutely. Let's not go there. I think we could be here all day. I just want to look, when we talk, we talk endlessly about existential threats, which is never a good sign. But the one that's often referred to is climate change. And I wonder, we talk about the environmental challenges of this, we've talked about net zero, ways in which it's adapted. I mean, has this already become a national security crisis for many countries, the climate? I mean, it obviously got something to do with immigration. We have war and climate change, a pretty horrific combination there. I mean, when does it become a kind of national security crisis? Is it already there, rather than just the environmental challenge?
I think that it is already. I mean, I think that it's quite difficult to separate out all the different things that drive like migration out of the Middle East
and Africa.
There's so much going on. But is climate change part of that? I think absolutely. It's part of that. There's some parts the Middle East are becoming hard for people to live in for climate change reasons. And so I think that it's very difficult to imagine a scenario in which the demand for migration out of the Middle East and into Europe is going to fall. And as we know, that many European countries, including Britain, already struggle with the politics of migration as it is, and the mismatch between what governments would like to do about it and what the majority of voters think should happen. I think the other thing that's in a way brought out by the sheer difficulties, and in some sense I would say the failure of like the Net Zero 2050 project, is that was always based, amongst the other optimistic assumptions in which it was based, I would say utopian assumptions in which it was based, on the notion that, well, we've got 30 years to fix this, and we can fix it by having an energy transition, actually more accurately an energy revolution. But that presumed that climate change would wait. And that's just nonsense. I mean, and so one of the things I think that happened, and I think one of the really bad mistakes of the way in which the set of issues around climate change and energy have been dealt with, is that adapting to climate change is seen as, and spending money on doing that, was seen as something that was bad. Because if you did that, you're being fatalistic about climate change and you're not betting on the energy transition to change it. But if climate change is now, then thinking that the solution can wait until finishing it in 2050, it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And so I think that we are going to see pressure actually for stronger climate change adapting to climate change policies. But they are going to cost money.
Yeah.
I mean, and the British state is not proven very, and just to use Britain as an example, at spending money on flood defences.
So that's a question of infrastructure, really. Which, of course, Britain's particularly good at, as we all know. I'm trying to end this discussion, Helen, on a positive note. I feel this might be beyond us, given what we've discussed over the last, over 2025. But I wonder if, looking back at the year, do you think all of the topics we've just discussed have been well rehearsed, they're talked about, they're part of public debate? Do you think there's an issue that is under discussed?
That's a good question. I think perhaps what's under discussed is the way in which that they fit together. Or the ways in which we need to try to think systemically about them. I think that certain things are definitely better discussed than they were prior to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, because I think that certain things came to the surface then. Both, I mean, energy is the obvious example, but some aspects of geopolitical conflict, I think, also the case. But I still think that there's a tendency, particularly perhaps in Europe, including us in that, to think about the questions with some insularity. And that's why I sort of, in a way, banged on a lot about this year when I'm talking about the importance for us in Europe to get to grips with this Western Hemisphere question.
And how do we do that?
Well, I think that's, it's partly a question of, in a way, which I'm sure you'd be sympathetic to, Paul, needing like a better historical understanding of the period from the end of the 19th century, you know, the period in which the United States rose, in the way in which we talked about like earlier to now, and in Europe, really, in a way, rethinking our own history in relation to that, which means like decentering Europe in some respects. I still think that we in Europe find it quite hard to give up on the idea that somehow world history, if you like, can be understood with Europe at the centre of it.
No, absolutely. And I think this comes down to a lot of the kind of navel-gazing of academia is one of those. There's the nature of language learning, and which is particularly, I mean extra European languages by that, which is catastrophic in this country and no doubt elsewhere as well. Of course, Russian, Chinese, Arabic being the classic examples. Why are we not investing more money in that and this global position? I also think it comes back. It's interesting you talk about history. We both write history books. It's taken a really bad turn over the last 30 years. The ability to talk about the past to a wider public that's engaged. Yeah. I mean, we know our friends Tom Holland yeah. and Dominic Sandbrook with the rest of history have demonstrated in quite spectacular style that there's a real public appetite for that, and the essential kind of tragic nature of the human condition, and in the widest sense of the tragic, I mean, in order to understand it, that you get that sense when you look at statesmen, statespeople of the past, the De Gaulles, the Churchills, yeah. even the Thatchers, got that nature of historical propulsion, if you like, and looked for analogies elsewhere. That seems to have been lost almost entirely, to a certain extent, because we're in denial about the great man, woman. And we don't have many of those at the moment in politics.
I mean, obviously it's not always a solution, because I think that in different ways, probably Merkel more seriously, but Macron to some extent, have, from what we read about, what they read anyway, tried to like grapple like with longer history. I mean, I suspect in Macron's case that it is distorted by the fact of just how hard he finds giving up on the idea of Europe. And actually, when he means Europe, he means France.
Yeah, of course.
As the centre of the pivot of world history. But I think if you look at our leaders, you probably can't see it, I think, since Thatcher. I mean, obviously, Johnson thought that he was in some respect, but
it's all
very self-indulgent
reading, it's almost performative,
in ways to sort of cast himself in these historical
it's an act, basically. There's no substance there.
I don't think that I think that in Britain we particularly lacked it in our political class.
Is there anyone on the world stage who you think, well, they're doing a pretty decent job within their own terms, someone who's got some stature, who is confronting the issues that we've discussed?
I don't know what the answer to that is, partly because I just think I'm too ignorant to know about what's true about the quality of political leadership, particularly outside Europe. If you looked in Europe, I guess the person who's sort of succeeded in some ways, much as I dislike the way in which he's done, is Orban. Mm. In the sense of that he has been there a long time now. He's weathered a set of what you would think of as quite difficult situations for Hungary. But having said that, I mean, there's certain ways, particularly Hungary's economic performance, where Hungary has not done well. I mean, I guess that you...
And he hasn't been able to reverse the demographic changes.
No, I'm just to say that, I mean, however hard he's tried on that... I mean, it's really, I guess I just said him for the fact of the endurance-like factor through all.
Maloney's been a bit of a surprise.
When you asked the question, Paul, I was about to... my first answer was going to be Maloney, but I've begun to wonder a little bit more, particularly on, like, whether or where she really is, like, on the Ukraine question.
Yeah.
And given that that's a... was quite important to her starting place. She seems to have moved away from it, which might suggest that it's more sort of performance of having a coherent strategy than actually having one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you said, like, what is Meloni's, like, long-term project for Italy, I'm not sure I would know what the answer to that is. Where, whatever I think of it, if you say what is Orban's long-term project for Hungary, we could give an answer to what he was... What the aspiration was.
And what he's laid out as a blueprint.
Yeah.
Are there any hopeful signs at all, looking back on 2025 or looking ahead to 2026?
I mean, I still think that the fact that the fault lines have come to the fore and are much more overt than they were and are more, like, openly... discussed.
Yeah.
And in some ways that actually the political crises, like in Britain, are accelerating.
Yeah.
That is a better thing.
They're on the table.
They're on the period of actually not
denial
and and not just denial, but self-deception.
Delusion.
About it, is that, you know, if you look like at historical like change, the crises have to play themselves out.
And that has something to do with Trump, doesn't
it? One can hope that they play themselves out, you know, relatively peacefully, because obviously one of the ways in which eras have ended and the next one begun has been major wars, and we're absolutely, that's not the one way out of this that we want it to be. In some sense, perhaps that's what makes this one difficult, because great power conflict, which has often been the end of an era, the beginning of another one, the stakes of it are now too high for that to be the resolution. So maybe part of the stasis comes from the absence of that. But nonetheless, I
suppose
there
are demographic reasons behind that as well.
Absolutely. And then I still think, though, that getting out of denial and deception is a better thing than being in it, not least because the risks become better understood.
Well, I do feel I'm a bit less delusional having spoken to you, Helen, today. It's been fascinating, as always.
It's been a pleasure, Paul.
Well, let's hope there is some light ahead in 2026. But it may be hard to find, but we'll try. Thank you, Helen. Helen Thompson, thank you very much.
Thanks.